On this episode of the Dusty Allen Show, I'm joined by William Billy Basil. Born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia, Bill shares what life was like growing up in the south of the US and how he bounced around different sports in high school, even trying his hand at diving at one point. After settling on the sport of golf, Bill now runs US Kids Golf in Australia. We have a laugh about the differences between golfers in the US compared to Australia, his close-up counters with Aussie wildlife, as well as uncovering the parallels between golf and life. A charming yarn full of southern hospitality, this one. Come on in. The water's great.
You're now listening to the Dusty Allen Show.
Welcome to the Dusty Allen Show.
William Basil, welcome to the Dusty Allen Show.
Thank you, man. Yeah, it's good to be here. Appreciate it.
You're the second American that we've had on the show.
Oh, good.
Thank you for coming on the show. Now, as with like a lot of our guests, not a lot of the audience probably won't know who you are, but that's exactly how I like it, because I think there's some of the best stories you can get from the people that you haven't met yet and that you didn't know about. So, mate, invited you on the show because I think you're an incredibly interesting person. And we don't generally have people on the show here who aren't interesting as well. So definitely tick that box. But, mate, I'm stoked to have you here. And I suppose to take it back, we've indicated like how we met, you know, basketball, support bras, things like that. And we can touch on that a little bit later. But tell me how you ended up down in Australia being from the States.
Yeah. How early do you want me to start? Just...
You know what? No, let's go back, because one of the what piqued my interest is when we were conversing a little while ago, and we were chatting about, obviously, sports is probably a big reason why we've become friends, both playing in the same basketball team, a shared interest for sports, you know, golf, basketball, that sort of thing. But what sort of struck me was, yeah, just your experiences of growing up in the States, high school, then into college, and the role that sport played in that. And I suppose the basketball was the main point. I don't know whether it was we were talking about.
Yeah, we were talking about just coaching and high yes. school sports in America versus yes. here, and then like adult sports in Australia versus America yes. and the differences.
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe like the first thing is I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia.
Yes.
So the South. And grew up in an Atlanta that was drastically changing post-Olympics. I think there's some history there. Maybe it was supposed to be the Sydney Olympics or the Melbourne Olympics or something, and mm-hmm. Atlanta got it because Coke bought it. And then, so the Atlanta I grew up in was way different than the Atlanta my parents grew up in. They both are from Atlanta as well. And drastically growing, lots of Fortune 500 companies moving satellite offices to Atlanta because it was cheaper, the weather was good, people had come down to the Olympics and seen how nice it was, and they said, you know what, let's branch out here. So really lucky, both my parents pretty much supported me with whatever I wanted to do, and oddly enough, I just wanted to play every sport under the sun.
Yep.
So basketball in the winter, baseball in the spring, soccer in the spring at the same time. I think I played roller hockey in the summer
yep.
because in the South we don't have any ice. I swam on the swim team.
So is that what you're saying? That's why the Atlanta Thrashers never made it in the NHL?
Definitely. I think the Thrashers didn't make it solely because Atlanta's too hot for all the snowbirds that want to come down.
Yep.
And then Florida's just where everyone retires. So the Florida teams get away with it. Nashville does really well because it's kind of a little bit farther north, so it's yep. a little bit cooler. But for most people, Atlanta just isn't the Minnesota or the Canada to Atlanta isn't really the move.
And can like going back a step with it, was it how big a deal was it? Because I remember when Sydney got the Olympics here, and it was around when I was finishing high school, and it was a big deal. Like we'd had Olympics before, I think Melbourne 56, that sort of thing, and it was a huge deal. Was it a big deal for Atlanta to get it? Was like a surprise? Was like had there what sort of impact from did it have on the city?
Yeah, I was only seven, so. All I remember is just it being the most crazy, wild experience that I could ever imagine as a child. Every family member, every friend of a friend, everybody that we knew was either staying at our house or staying at my aunt and uncle's house. Like, it was just, it was the place to be for a summer. So everything I've heard, though, is that it just drastically changed the outlook of Atlanta, similar with Delta coming to Atlanta and us deciding to build that massive airport, which I think today is still the largest human-trafficked airport, not human trafficking.
Hartfield-Jackson.
Yeah. So I just know that from what I saw growing up and what I've now learned as an adult is that, you know, the Atlanta my dad grew up in, totally different than the one I grew up in.
And a reason I ask, it piqued my curiosity, because I was in Barcelona recently and a friend of mine, we did a bit of like a running tour around the place, and he was pointing out to me, so they had the Olympics in 92 and saying Barcelona is a really good example of like the legacy left from having Olympics has been really good as far as the city was able to absorb a lot of the new infrastructure that was built, and it's gone on to be great, whether it be public spaces or recreational places, that sort of thing. Is that the same thing that you remember from the Atlanta Olympics?
No, I think most of the new arenas, the new builds that happened, they were all downtown. And still at the time, you weren't really downtown unless you got a parking ticket and you needed to go down and argue it.
Yep.
It wasn't, you went to the Falcons games, you went to Braves games, you went to Hawks games, all downtown. There was probably a large list of large companies that had offices down there, but you didn't go down there unless there was a sporting event to go to. So we didn't really assume it until probably here the last couple of years, where a lot of that area of the city is gentrifying and people are building new houses and townhouses, and it's becoming the place to be, which is all new.
And having spent some time in Atlanta over the years, and so not like regularly, but I think 2012 maybe, and then in 2019, I think when they had the Super Bowl, and being able to sort of spend a bit more time in the city and it not being a one of those holiday trips where it's saying, you know, one with the boys, it's maybe a sports trip, a bit boozy, this and that.
Yeah.
And the, I know for the life of me, can't remember the place. Well, we might have discussed this before. It's like an old...
are you talking bars?
Old building that's been turned into like a shopping precinct.
So that's Ponce City Market?
That's the one, yes.
Yeah, so it used to be the old Sears building.
Right.
So I don't know, we're probably too young for this, but I know I am, but the Sears catalog used to be a massive deal, and you would get the Sears catalog supposedly and order from it. And so they had this massive warehouse and this massive office space in Atlanta to, you know, basically run their business. So it was the old Sears building forever, and then it was empty for probably 20 years.
Yep.
And probably really similar to like what we see in Melbourne here with like St. Kilda and Collingwood and Richmond, like it wasn't really an area you wanted to hang out in after dark, and they've changed all that. Now it's vibrant. It's where you want to be.
And I've heard that Atlanta just evolving continuously as a city. And you talked about being like gentrified and stuff, and is a good example of how a city can change its perception, I suppose.
Yeah.
And one place that I got a hot tip to go check out from a buddy of mine. I won't name him. He's a good friend. G'day, Rob Tubajon. Was the Hotel Claremont.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And it's like quite unique for a particular reason.
For
and
sure.
And things that you don't quite see. But it was pointed out to me by numerous people as a place to check out purely because it's maybe a little bit whether you're like PC or a bit R-rated, but it's actually quite quirky.
Yeah, I would say it's a character spot. You know, it's a freckle. It's something that you want to go see because it's different. And if you're if you're somebody that likes to have fun and have a beer or two, it's a great place to just go hang out with your friends because it's one of those places that's probably, you know, becoming more and more limited as an option in the world.
Yes. And I won't dance around the issue here. It's basically would you call it a strip club or is it a bar with strippers?
It's definitely a bar with strippers. Yes. And people joke it's where strippers go to die.
Right.
So you have some strippers that are past their prime, simply put. But it's a place you go sit with a friend at the bar, have a few drinks. The lady behind the bar is probably not dressed appropriately. There's a few girls walking around that probably could be potentially your grandmother's age. That are also not dressed appropriately, but it's, you know, they're coming around maybe asking if you want to take a shot with them, give them a tip, make the bar some money. It's fun.
Yeah, as as wholesome you could probably make that yes. situation as possible, like a mature, slightly R-rated Hooters
type yeah, there
situation.
You go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Grandma's yep. Hooters.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and it's definitely, and I say this to everyone, it's definitely something that they need to check out if they go there, because it is a bit, I suppose, a small culture icon, a freckle, as yeah. as you put it. And one thing I do want to clarify, if anyone is still listening at this point in time, is not we're not here to talk about like strippers, and but just where I wanted to probably go back, and we touched on to start, is high school for you.
Yeah.
And you strike me as someone who was academic as well as athletic. But the story that stuck out for me was like a bit of a turning point, I suppose. And in some ways, it's probably landed you in Australia.
For sure.
Is where it came, where you had to choose a sport, but you chose an option that's probably not that common amongst.
Yeah. So I like I said earlier, I played every sport growing up, but then you had a lot of pressure to try to pick something that you were good at, which I wasn't very good at doing. So. Once I got into ninth grade, I ran cross country in the fall. I was stuck between playing golf and playing lacrosse in the spring, and then I played basketball in the winter. Our basketball team was really, really good. A handful of guys that either went and played football in university or basketball. But I guess junior year, the option was given to me by the coach after tryouts to either be on the team and never see the court. So
and can I just clarify, yeah. for those who don't know, junior year, that's your equivalent of year 11?
Yeah, year 11. Year 11. Yeah, so year 11, sorry, I'll try to use proper
No, look, and we're pretty educated bunch, the audience of the Dusty Allen Show. I'm sure they can work it out. But for those who aren't familiar with these sort of things, yeah.
All yeah, good. So... Yeah, you know, obviously sports are getting a little bit more serious. I went to a school where you're either going to be really, really smart and go to Yale, you're going to be really good at a musical instrument or some other art, or you're going to be really good at a sport. And if you weren't going to play a sport or do one of those things in university, I wouldn't say you were looked down upon, but it wasn't cool.
Mm.
So you really, there was a lot of pressure to be good at what you did.
Was it when you were offered the opportunity to play in the basketball team, because I feel like that's probably one thing that a lot of people around the world can relate to, like it's well portrayed in like movies and it's like you make the team and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Did it come from the coach like, hey, you're welcome, I'll put you on the team because you won't play, but you get to tell people you're on the team. And is it like a status
yeah.
thing, or is it a personal achievement thing?
I think it was definitely a status thing. Mm. So being on the basketball team would have been great with the girls. It would have been great
yep.
With interacting with people, having connection points with your community at your school. But I was running cross country, so I was late to tryouts for the varsity basketball team.
Yep.
So I got there a couple days into varsity basketball tryouts, and the coach pulled me in and was like, hey, you know, obviously I love your work ethic. I want you on the team, but I know you have a lot going on and you do a lot of other things. I don't want to basically lie to you. So if you're going to be on the team, you need to know you're probably never going to play. Mm. I'm going to love to have you as basically a practice player to guard the guys and get them ready for the game each week. So I chose not to play because that didn't sound like a lot of fun.
And was that what percentage of, this is a point I'm curious on, what percentage of people would say no to that? Is it like 50-50 or there are a lot of kids out there who would say, yeah, anything to be on the team and they would just be a practice player?
Anybody that didn't have probably as many things going on as I did would have jumped at the opportunity to be on the team.
Yep.
You know, you're getting a jersey. Every game day you're getting to wear your jersey down the hallway at school. Everybody knows you're on the basketball team.
So that's another thing. Like game yeah. day, you wear your top.
Your
like
kit. Yeah.
So if it's football, wear the football jersey. Any other sports? Is it mainly football, basketball? Are they
football, basketball? Usually, you know, like I want to say the baseball team did it when they had a big game.
Yep.
But they played more games than the basketball or football team did. But the basketball team probably didn't even do it other than Friday night games because they might have a Tuesday or Wednesday night game as well.
Right.
But for the football team, for sure. So there'd be 100 kids running around school every day with their jersey on.
yep.
every Friday because they had a Friday night game.
Yep.
And they wanted everybody to know they were on the football team.
Yeah.
You know, Letterman jackets, all everything you can imagine. I had to wear a uniform, khaki or chino pants and mm-hmm. a golf shirt every day.
Yep.
So I chose not to do it because, you know, I was running. I had what ended up being golf as my big sport in the spring. The funny thing was, is my dad, when I got to year nine, if I didn't play a sport during a particular season, I had to get a job.
Right.
So I think that was his way of making me play a sport because he knew I would do that. He just wanted me to be busy, and probably as a parent, the busier he is, the less likely he is to get in trouble.
Yep.
Because he'll be too dang tired to do anything else. So I ended up being on the diving team my junior and senior year when I quit basketball, which was only practice was twice a week and then 1 week meets. And there was a guy on my team, on the diving team, that ended up like diving the Olympics. So I was just there jump off the diving board.
Basically. So what you learned there, could you go down to the local swim joint and do like something pretty fancy?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Twists and pikes and like what was your springboard platform? What?
It was 1 meter. So it was a 1 meter springboard. Yeah. So I think my routine was like an inward dive, an inward flip, a double flip, a 1.5 flip, and then something else. I think I did like a backwards 1.5 thingy. That was like my big move. But I'll never forget, there's probably 300 people in the what I would call like the pool auditorium.
Yep.
The diving was going on before the swim meet at the same time. But so there's about 300 swimmers in there getting ready for the swim meet, and I'm doing my diving, and it's my turn to do a double flip. And I belly flopped so bad that like my ears didn't even get below the water. So I heard the ooh so strong. And like I'm sure that my whole body was red because I had belly flop, but it was more embarrassed. I remember just sinking down to the bottom and being like, "Oh, how am I going to get back up and go again?"
Wow, that mate, I'd had no diving. So you've rattled off a couple of sports here,
yeah.
And obviously, basketball's a passion for you. So to sort of say no to something, but you also, I think it's, I don't know why it strikes me so much because I feel like there'd be a lot of people who just jump at the chance to be on the status team. And so then when you just made that call, was it something you chatted to your parents about and said, I don't want to do this? Or were they not really fussed what sport you were doing as long as you were doing a sport?
Yeah, great question. My mom didn't care at all. She just wanted me to be happy. She wanted me to play a sport because she didn't want me to get a job. She wanted me to be a kid. My dad was probably a lot more adamant that he wanted me to play lacrosse because that's what all the cool kids played.
Really?
Yeah.
And so it wasn't football or basketball.
They did that as well, but lacrosse was in the spring.
Of course.
So all the football players that, you know, are playing lacrosse in the spring, staying staying fit,
yep.
you know, getting to run into each other just like football. And I love lacrosse, but I really like golf.
Yeah.
And, but my dad wanted me to play lacrosse. He's like, it's really, you're only going to get to play lacrosse like for these next couple of years of your life and it'll be over. And that's something else you and I talked about is like, in American sports, come year 12, in most cases, you'll never get an opportunity to play a competitive sport again. It's not like Australia.
No.
The church league, what we call church league, what you guys might call like rec league or competitive men's league basketball, you know, our version would be 2 courts worth of players, whereas IMSAC's 10 for 4 hours a night. You know, it's just a much, much more limited opportunity. You're not really playing, you're not playing baseball, you're not playing lacrosse, you're not playing any of those team sports after year 12.
That, just something about that, and maybe because societally here, sport is such a big part of Australian communities and society, it just seems so sad that, and it makes sense now because we get, a lot of this stuff, I said it piques my curiosity because growing up, we watch, it's all American movies that we watch and you look at their schools and that looks so different. Like they have the sports is such a big deal. But then you also notice that in the movies where it portrays adults in some situation, they're always just playing rec league stuff, whether it's like pickup basketball or a baseball game where everyone's not wearing the same uniform or those sort of things. So
they're at the YMCA or they're at like a work function where they're playing softball. Yes,
and it's super cash.
Super casual.
And the fact that there might be some kids in high school or even say like university, if you get to go there, like, but you're not playing past that, it makes so much sense now why there is, you say, look, as an example that stands out, like Friday Night Lights football in Texas or, you know, the basketball team or even like then college, all that sort of stuff, why it's so big. So
for sure. There's a reason 110,000 people will go to a college football game.
Mm.
It's because most of them are living vicariously through those players and have been their entire adult life.
Yeah.
Because they don't get to play football anymore.
Yeah.
Same with high school stuff. You know, every single person in a small town in America remembers the feeling of going to a big Friday night football game and there being a couple thousand people there, if not more. And that would be like there being a couple thousand people at a seniors footy game in Hyatt. You know, chances are that wouldn't happen. You might get a couple hundred, but you're not going to get 5,000. There's not going to be a stadium that they're playing at. But the only reason that occurs is because there's so many people that love that sport that don't get to do it anymore.
So that's where the crowd comes from as well. And then I'm guessing additional, say, cities that don't have a professional sporting team in a particular sport will then get around their high schools or their colleges and things?
For sure. Mm. For sure. Exactly the same way. And I think that was a big thing you and I talked about that kind of piqued your interest was just it's so different. And even once you move into uni sports, you know, if you get the opportunity to play in uni, which might be, depending on the sport, 1 or 1.5% of the population of players that play at under 18, you're only doing it for another 4 years, if you're lucky, if you don't get hurt, and then that's over. And you're probably become the one that's the weird sports guy because you did it longer and you think you know a lot more about it. So it'd be like playing, VFL footy. You all of a sudden now, like you go to a game and you think you know what the coach should be telling the players to do.
Right. Okay. That can be a bit weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
Become the weird. Yeah. Yeah. The guy just can't let go.
Yeah. You can't let go. Yeah.
I saw somebody the other day, some guy who was going in for like his eighth year of basketball at some college or something. And I didn't read too deep into the article. I'm guessing you saw it as well.
Like, I did.
Is that just how does that happen?
Well, COVID happened, which gave everyone an extra year.
Mm-hmm.
And then there has also been a lot of changes with the NCAA and how they have been mandating the rules. You know, when I was playing college sports, I couldn't get paid to do anything else other than I washed all the dirty clothes in the athletic washroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked in the weight room. So I would go clean up the weights every 45 minutes. And otherwise, I would study.
Yep.
And that was how I could get paid. And that was just a job any student could have gotten. But I kind of got the step in because I was an athlete. But now, I mean, you know, you got LeBron James's son's a freshman in uni. And I think he's valuated at like over $5 million.
Mm.
You've got some gymnasts. You've got some basketball players, both male and female, that are doing great for themselves outside of university sport, which I've always thought makes a lot of sense. But when I was there, NCAA technically owned your likeness.
Right.
So you weren't allowed to go push yourself in any particular endeavor other than you could go work at a coffee shop or at a bar, but you couldn't do anything with your likeness as like, I'm a University of Georgia football player. Come buy a car from this car dealership. You couldn't do that, which now you can.
Yeah.
So it's great. You know, I think the whole University of Utah football team all got like Nissan Tundras or something this season as, you know, a big sponsorship that the car dealership did with the school. So it's definitely opening up the doors to allow players and students the opportunity to actually make some real money when they have the opportunity to. Because like I said a second ago, you might not ever have a chance to make any money.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I think it's always been a talking point where everyone starts to realize, especially the amount of money that the NCAA was making off the athletes. And then if you watch like docos like the Johnny Manziel one where he obviously was doing it outside the rules, but you're watching, you think, well, that makes sense. Like he was probably always going to go sign a deal and make money anyway. But
right.
The big name players in college, like what can they be? What can they be making? Maybe take someone like a LeBron or son LeBron's son out of it. You know.
Yeah. Let's say you're the best player in your state. You get in high school. So year 12, you're graded the number one player in your state in whatever sport. Let's say it's a sport that makes a lot of money, like football or basketball. I would assume a school's probably putting some sort of marketing package together for you that's making you $150,000 a year at least to make you want to go there.
Yep.
So that's being done by boosters, and booster is defined, I think, usually as somebody that basically just supports a university and wants that university to be good at sports, so they give money to that school. I know you don't like to do like the timing stuff, but a Texas A&M coach just got fired, and he's owed $72 million on his contract for a university football coach, and the school just fired him and going to pay him out. And they do that with booster money. So all the big oil guys in Texas just said, oh, we don't like this coach anymore. We'll pay for it.
Right. So in a weird way, it's kind of like politics a little bit.
Yeah,
like
very much so.
The backers, like, we don't like this guy. We'll just, and they have a say. Like they're almost like the board. Yeah, wow.
That's okay. Probably the best way to make a parallel to Australia is it becomes a bit like politics.
And then just the wealthy people keep supporting the school. I think saw a good example of that. The ones that dumb it down for us who, and when I say us, like back in the day, I think it might have been the Blind Side. You see the Tui family, it might have been, you know, clearly had a fair bit of money and were able to, I think they were referred to as boosters and whatnot. Or
correct, yeah. Yeah, and that's come back out in the news again too. But yeah, it's definitely a different, very different world, and I don't think it really made a lot of sense and didn't make a lot of sense for a long time. And finally, the NCAAs had to give up their, what I would call in quotations, control that they probably didn't deserve to have.
Are they still making a lot of money?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They're not going hungry.
No, they're doing just fine. Yeah.
And what school did you go to? Tell me a bit about the school that you went to after high school.
Yeah, so I went to a small liberal arts school called Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. So a 6-hour drive away from home, which was what I wanted. I didn't want my parents to be able to show up randomly. I wanted them
6 hours is just far enough?
Yeah, I figured just far enough for like a random day trip wasn't possible. My parents were super happy with that. I played golf, and the reason I went there, it was a Division III school, so I didn't get any athletic aid from the school to go there, but I did end up getting a little bit of academic aid, and I got free golf. Yep. So we played at some of the best golf courses in Memphis every day of the week, and had, you know, my just as good of an opportunity to become a professional golfer as anybody else. I obviously could have gone and played. I couldn't have because I wasn't good enough, but could have gone and played at a big university with, you know, somebody telling me what to eat and someone having me in the gym 3 or 4 days a week, and then multiple coaches teaching me how to swing, all that kind of stuff. But I don't think that it does you a lot of good to get good at golf. But I don't think it's why you make it in golf. Unfortunately, golf's just way too much of a mental sport, as any of us that play it know. As much as you think you know what's going on, that's when you do poorly, it's when you think you know what's going on.
I think that sometimes a good analogy for other things in life as well. Like when I think with dating, when I think I know what's going on, that's sort of normally when I'm going to trip myself up. Or life's going great. Yeah, it was good. Then, little stumbles coming.
Yeah, yeah. We can cuss, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, it's called the birdie fuck up. So you make a birdie, and then the next hole you're automatically going to play poorly because it's just how life works. You get super excited that you did well in something. You know, you got a raise, you got a promotion, whatever it may be, and then you cool off a little bit and start taking things for granted, and before you know it, you've made a mistake and you feel like crap. I think for me, golf has always been a really, really big connection point in life, and it's taught me a lot, I think, with meeting people, introducing myself, feeling comfortable in those environments that a lot of people I don't think feel comfortable as like a young person, because I was constantly around old people.
Yeah.
So, you know, 14-year-old Bill's like, hello, Mr. Allen, good to see you. And I just thought I owned the room, which is really weird, but I think it helped me as I got older, because, you know, I go into a job interview or I go into a sales pitch with somebody and I don't think I'm 20 years younger than them, or I don't think I don't know what's going on. I feel quite confident that what I'm going to do in this particular place is going to be okay.
When you think about it, it's actually a good way to learn, like networking, like you're around, like for a young person, I mean, you're around older people. And generally, like most, if you're at a golf club, there's generally people who are, it's a, you know, a higher disposable income sport is what it generally lends itself to. But I think in the last couple of years, it's really opened up to be a sport for most people once you can get the equipment and whatnot. But
yeah, high barrier to entry sport. Mm. Because it costs a lot to get started.
Mm.
But once you get going, it's, you know, maybe it's kind of like surfing. You know, once you get the surfboard, you pay for that, you can make it happen. But it's getting everything together to go play golf and the clothes and knowing where to go, all that kind of stuff. But that's why I moved to Australia, to go back to one of your original questions. So I work for a golf company. It's called US Kids Golf.
Mm-hmm.
We sell golf clubs. We make golf clubs, sell golf clubs for junior golfers, and then run golf tournaments for juniors as well. We do it all over the world, and I moved to Australia a little over 4 years ago to manage the Australian branch of that company.
Yep.
And I got into it really luckily. The guy that started it 25 years ago, his kids and I played youth sports together. So he kind of knew who I was, and when I was graduating from uni, he wanted me to come have a networking meeting at the office, and within about 15 minutes I realized it wasn't a networking meeting. I was being interviewed.
Yeah.
And 12 years later, here I am.
Rest is history.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things you did mention previously, or not here, but when we were chatting, and it's just the difference between golf in Australia and golf in the States. And I'm a mad golfer. You've seen me play, very much middle of the road, and don't practice that much. Take it a bit too seriously at times, stress out, don't hit a good shot. You know, forget what we've just talked about, is like expectation, like you're not going to cream everyone. But what was the biggest, did you have much of an idea of the golf landscape before you came to Australia?
No, I think the first thing I did when I got offered the job, they said, hey, do you want to move to Melbourne or Sydney? And I Googled top 10 golf courses in Australia and saw that about 8 of them were either in Melbourne or Tassie.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only a few outside of that. So I said Melbourne.
Yep.
And I learned how to say Melbourne.
I noticed that just then. Yeah. I was like, he nailed that. Yep. Perfect.
But golf for me is a lot different than it was. But I think a lot of that has to do with like how deep I took it and how serious I took it at one point in my life. And now, like, what I see it as is, like, it's a great way to meet you.
Yep.
It's a great way to meet someone that I don't know. If you can spend 4 hours with somebody walking around in a park, basically on a walk, and you guys don't want to kill each other at the end, some sort of bond has been created there that you're probably not getting in any other, if you want to call golf athletic, any other athletic endeavor.
That's actually spot on, and it's similar to an analogy that once was shared with me, is like a good test or a measure of a person is if you could be stuck at the airport with them for 4 to 8 hours, then you know they're probably okay. And like I said, not want to kill them, not want to
leave, walk away.
Yep, yeah. Exactly.
Go hide. Yeah.
And the more I think about it, because I'll be honest, I like to just play with my mates. If we can get a foursome, like that's great. But occasionally it's three. It's either an odd number, anything less than four, you're gonna be playing with someone else, especially when it's so busy. And there's always that bit of angst where I hope the person who turns up, I hope they're not weird, I hope they're not a dickhead, I hope they're not arrogant or take it too serious and those sort of things. Mm-hmm. But I'll be honest, in the amount of times you've played with randoms, which is numerous, I could probably count on one hand where the person's actually been like an asshole, like a bad person.
Yeah.
Other than that, might not be someone you vibe with, but it's fine. You know, and you,
exactly.
Especially, I normally get a bit of a break because I spend a bit of time in the bush and there's a bit of solitude there as well. So then you come back, how are you going? Yeah, good. So it's not 4 full hours.
No, right? Totally. I think the biggest difference is from being an adult playing golf in America and then golf here. First step, everybody in America is taking a golf cart, if possible.
Yes.
If you're walking, you're weird. So like I was always a walker because I wanted to get some sweat up. Mm. I wanted to have some sort of exercise. I'd probably had too many the night before. And in my mind, it was a great way to feel better about myself that it was okay. I had a few the night before because I walked. Whereas my friends would get in the golf cart and immediately start having more beer, which is totally fine. And not like I didn't have a few beers walking down the fairway, but at least I was walking. So golf was, I think, for a lot of people in the States, it's I had a 65-hour week, a 70-hour week at work. I love my children, but I can't wait for some solitude. Whatever they might have going on in their life, golf was the way to go have a outlet. And that outlet had a little to do with the golf and a lot more to do with the people they were playing with and the fun they were going to have. And I think here, for a multitude of reasons, but I think also just like we talked about plenty of times, the amount of competitive sport that adults play here, golf is, in their mind, it's a competitive sport. Mm. You know, you're going out there and you want to do well and you want your handicap to go down and you want to impress yourself.
yes.
Yeah. And so like that took a little bit of understanding for me because I've always been told here, like, oh, you're so chill. Like you don't really give a crap.
And you are.
Like, I'm like, pretty... I don't really give a crap, but I probably give more of a crap than a lot of my friends at home did.
Right.
You know, they'd hit a ball in the woods and you'd go look for it, Dusty. They would just say, ah, I'll see you guys on the next one and get in the cart and drink a beer. And, you know, look on their phone or, like, answer an email like, I'll see you guys on the next tee. Just, you know, let me know if you need some sand or something to fill a divot. So it's just, it's different. And I do miss that part of it sometimes because it was so relaxing. Mm. I was the one that had to be brought to the relaxation level, whereas now I'm trying to bring everyone I play with to my relaxation level.
You're spot on. You're like I feel like a golf Yoda. Yeah. And because the time we played and that fellow chucked the club on like the second thing. And I was like, ooh, like it's awkward.
Yeah, for sure.
And you're like, oh, okay. And I go back and I've on a previous episode chatting with, a yoga instructor, was talking about how men, we're weird creatures and men are so embarrassed to do yoga and they say, I'm not good at it. Mm. And so they don't want to look silly in front of people. But then you go to the golf course where some guys are terrible at golf. They don't practice. They look silly in front of people, but they don't care because it's all like a different mentality. And the worst thing that ever happened to me as a golfer is like to play well a little bit and you're like, oh, and the older thing is like, I got this worked out. It's easy. And then never easy, but I've cracked the code. I can continue to get better. And
it's like marking a footy. It's like kicking a goal. It's like shooting a free throw. I've sorted this out.
Yep. I've got it nailed. And I played 20 years of amateur footy, country footy, but I practiced twice a week, did a preseason. Mm-hmm. And since I could walk. And then who the fuck do I think I am to go onto the golf course and think I'm going to shoot less than 80?
Or better than I did last time, and I haven't hit a golf ball since then.
Yep, and I haven't warmed up. I'm maybe having a beer and stuff. So, and I took something away from that round. The players like, you know what? Just enjoy the good ones, forget about the bad ones. But it's almost like I need this mantra before I go out, like the Lord's Prayer before you go. So remember, thy drives done, thy bunkers won, something like that.
Yeah, I think something that I think the golf shows or when you're watching a golf tournament on TV, it does you a disservice. Like it's basically like watching a highlight reel. So you watch 4 hours of golf and you basically watch the 4-hour highlight reel of the best players and their best shots of the day. You don't really see a lot of the bad ones until maybe the fourth round at the end when one of the leaders hits a bad shot. That's when you see the bad ones. But man, if you actually go watch somebody shoot 66, they hit 4 or 5, you're like, I could hit that shot. That's really bad. But then they hit 10 or 12 that you go, nope, that's not in the bag. I don't have that one. And that's why they shot 66. So you don't see the bad ones. And like for anyone that's a 90 or 95 shooter in golf, like, yeah, if you don't hit golf balls twice a week in between rounds, there's no excuse for throwing a club because you haven't tried. Mm. You're trying in the moment, but you haven't tried to get any better. You're just there because you're competitive, and that's why people play golf. Mm. It's every competitive person in the world plays golf because they go, why can't I figure this out? Why is it so damn hard? I do enjoy being outside. I'm an outdoor athletic person. I like being outside. This is fun. But why is it so hard, and why can't I figure it out? And if you're not sitting there training and practicing, and you know, like you said, like twice a week preseason practice.
Yep.
If you're not taking it seriously, then you know you can't throw a club.
Well, you can.
You can.
Yeah. It's the I've done it, and as soon as you do it, you're like, what are you doing?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You're like, nothing good comes from it. Like, you wanted to, but best advice I got from John Harrington, good mate of mine, you know, plays pretty steady golf out at Spring Valley. He goes, expectation, mate. He goes, you're not going to hit the shot you think you're going to hit every single time. Then when you hit a good one, yeah, just enjoy it. But I think the ego or the entitlement of a lot of Australians who put about as much effort into golf as me then go out thinking that they're gonna win the Stableford comp, you know, that day.
Yeah.
No.
But that's all of us, and that kind of goes back to life. So like if you don't give it your all, or at least a little bit of effort, you shouldn't expect a good return.
Man, we're getting into some wise stuff here, mate.
Yeah. I don't even think it's that wise, but I guess that's just me in golf. Like I always sit there and go, why do I like golf? Like, oh, well, it relates to life. Why do I like golf? Because it's damn hard, just like life. None of it's important, the golf part. But shoot, if you can take a few lessons from it and apply that to the things that actually are important in your life, maybe you'll be better off.
I think one of the reasons golf, from my perspective, and I'm part of it, I think exploded in Australia in the last like 4 years is due to partly COVID. Mm-hmm. And then there's one of the few things you could do. And now I was actually chatting to a friend of mine, and she hates golf, but she had to organize like some golf event for work. And she goes, golf sucks, hate golf, love being able to organize events, love being able to boss people around for the day. And by all images and videos that I saw, did a really, really good job. And she goes, do you like golf? I said, I fucking love it. It's great. I said, I'm not very good, blah, 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 but it's amazing. And I think the thing that I enjoy the most about it and have done is connection with friends. You like, and she goes, oh, you know, you can do that anytime. I said, no, no, no. Think about this. What is the way that you're going to get exercise? And I'd say a bigger proportion of people walk in Australia than the States. So where are you going to get exercise? Generally in good weather with your friends. And getting exercise, and you hit some good shots, you feel bad, the highs and lows, but just 4 hours. And you're rarely on your phone, I find, as well, that uninterrupted connection. And that's what I think makes it pretty special.
Yeah, exactly. And there's no television on. There's no food being served. There's no outside distraction of your ability to actually have a connection with somebody, whether it's them going through something with work, them going through something with their family, whatever it may be. It ends up being a great opportunity to talk about something because – you know, like we joked about, you're going to be with them for 4 hours. So you don't have to get into it right away. It's not like a quick coffee date with your friend to go, hey, how's it going? Like, tell me everything. And then they feel stressed out. They're like, oh, shit, I don't know. I'm not ready for that. I don't want to talk about it.
Yep.
Whereas in golf, it's like, oh, you know, dabble here, dabble there. All of a sudden, you actually do have a connection that you talk about something that you haven't talked to anyone about because you've had a couple hours of deciding whether you want to talk about it.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you're hitting some good shots. You're real chatty. you hit some bad ones. I'm just going to go quiet for a little while.
Exactly.
To see a bit of wildlife as well.
Yeah.
Have you come across any challenging wildlife since you've been playing down here?
I have. So I get, you know, as a Native American, I get sent by all my friends, every single one of those videos about all the kangaroos jumping around and people trying to hit, or those crabs that get stuck on people's bags. The only thing that really irks me are the crows at Royal Melbourne are some of the most aggressive animals I have ever met in my entire life. If you buy a sandwich and you put it in your bag and zip it up, they'll literally go down and unzip your bag and take the sandwich out. They're that smart. They know exactly what's going on. And the crows, they're healthy. You know, they're big boys. This isn't their first rodeo when it comes to eating people's food.
I think that happened to me across the road at Sandy the other week.
Yeah, and would have.
I'm like, if there's – and to give some context, like it's not just if you have a muesli bar or and just put it on your bag and walk, like they get in there and can carry on with – yeah, I was actually quite surprised how industrious they were.
Oh, yeah. So, like, you know, I'm sitting there laying my bag down, walking back to the tee box, get told by the guys I'm playing with, hey, don't leave your sandwich out. So I walk back down to my bag, put it in a zip-up pocket, and while I'm teeing off 50 yards away, I'm watching them get into my bag and start eating the sandwich, and I had to run down and shoo them away. So, yeah, they're quite good. But, yeah, I think having the kangaroos on the golf course is really fun. Kangaroos, to me, it's kind of like they're like a mix between a squirrel and a deer in the States. Mm-hmm. There's lots of them, which really you don't see a lot of deer anymore.
Yeah.
No, you don't see a lot of deer in the States. Yeah. But you will see deer on the golf course because that's really, you know, one of their only places where they can still kind of frolic unless they're out in the actual national forest. I haven't had any bad experiences other than the crows.
No, me neither, really. Like, touch wood.
Yeah. No spiders, no snakes, no nothing.
Like, I've seen a snake go up a pipe down in Tassie and had mates be swooped by magpies, but the maggies swooping don't really bother me that much. Like, I'm not one of those folks who puts the cable ties on the the helmet.
My second week here, I moved down and I'm riding my bike to work and I got swooped and I had not been told about this yet. So I get hit once and I'm like, man, this bird must be blind or something. Like, that was really weird. And then he hit me again, cut my ear up.
You've been cut by a magpie.
So I call my brand new housemate. You know, I used fairy floss and got this housemate. Don't know the guy at all. And I'm like, hey man, is there any chance a bird would be attacking me for any reason? And he goes, what color is it? And I was like, black and white. And he goes, nope, that doesn't make any sense, man. And just hangs up on me.
He stitched up his arm. Yeah.
Yeah. So I keep riding to work and I'm freaking out at this point. Finally get to work. He calls me back 15 minutes later. He's like, I can't stop laughing. Yeah, that happens. I should have told you. Sorry.
I thought you were just going to leave me there and not say anything. No. You work with children?
Yes.
You work with parents? And I'm super keen to know, like, how much in a particular golf space. I'm not familiar with that. I've seen a little bit of tennis, and it's probably more well-documented in tennis and things, and also my experience, you know, playing footy, basketball, whatnot, growing up. Is there a lot of – let's go to the kids. How resilient are kids these days as far as being young athletes go in a solo sport?
I feel like they're already 25 years old. Yeah, I talked to an 8-year-old, you know, when they finished their round of golf, and they, you know, they do care how they played, but they are just happy to be there. And it's something that I feel like we forget as adults. They're just stoked that they got to play golf with their friends, with kids their age. And something we do in our events, all the players under 10 have to have a caddy. So a lot of those caddies end up being parents. Sometimes they're coaches. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're siblings, grandparents, a lot of grandparent caddies. I love the sport as far as being in the junior golf space part of it because you get to see how mature these kids are. Mm-hmm. There's no way when I was 8 that I was having the conversations that these 8-year-olds are trying to have with me. You know, they're talking about lie angles and spin rates and how they hit their flop shot and why they hit it the way they do. And all I did was ask them how they played today. Mm. So they're consuming knowledge in my mind a lot deeper than we did.
And is that due to more access of it? Like they can watch YouTube videos, like anything, like kids playing footy here, they know stats, they're doing fantasy football and all that sort of stuff. And the same thing applies
here. Yeah, I think so. I think it's just all the access to information. And then, we get into the parent part of it. I'm running golf tournaments for 18 and unders, but the predominant amount of our market is 12 and under. So I'm running competitive golf events for people under 12 all the way down to 5-year-olds. So sometimes those parents are a bit nuts. And I send them all the love in the world, but I think Tiger and his story and even Rory's story and Jordan Spieth's story and Justin Thomas's story, it really makes parents think that they can make their kid that.
And then there goes all the expectations here, the realities here, and then there's just sadness, pain,
Yeah, there could be sadness and pain in the middle.
In the gap.
Yeah. And, you know, I see it's there's just as many players that are the best kid in their age group whose parents don't know anything about golf or do know a lot about golf but literally just hang out. As there are kids that are the best kid in their age group, and the parent you can tell is the one somewhat driving the experience. And I think individual sports are really tough because, you know, when I played baseball, you know, my dad was on the sidelines.
Yep.
He had nothing to do with it. Same with basketball. Had nothing to do with it. He didn't know why the coach was telling me to guard the person I was guarding or whatever it may have been. So my home environment was awesome game, great job. You know, if you just made that shot, how cool would that have been? But great job.
Yeah.
Whereas I think a lot of individual sport family dynamics become negative, where it's, why'd you do that? Didn't we talk about that?
Is that something you just observe and you just have to watch happen? Like with your role, like working with you, just you never weigh in and say, hey, like, if that's just something you just leave up to the children and their parents?
So as far as we're concerned, our goal is to help families have wonderful experiences together on the golf course. Yep. That's the main reason why we want caddies. Mm. We want the mom and dad and the kid to go when they're 25 years old and they're getting married saying, wow, how great was that you got to spend so much time together on the golf course and create a relationship that probably 50 years ago children and their fathers and mothers didn't really have.
Yeah.
But as long as the parent's not yelling at the child, degrading the child during the event, we can't do much.
Mm.
We keep an eye on it, you know, and we want to make sure that every caddy is doing the best they can to support the player and all the other kids in the group. But it's kind of, in my mind, 10% of the population ruins it for everyone else.
Mm.
So, you know, why is the speed limit what it is?
Yep.
Why are the rules what they are? Because of that 10% that wants to push the envelope. So,
well, that's why they put labels on plastic bags. Don't put it over your head because someone's done it.
Yeah.
When we have to abide by the rules for the lowest common denominator as well. Mm. Yeah. Yep.
I think individual sports make it more difficult. But that doesn't mean there aren't the crazy dads that are the crazy footy dads and the crazy basketball dads. Mm. And, you know, I remember there was a guy on my basketball team all the way through high school, or at least, you know, till I stopped playing basketball, that his dad came to every practice, but he wasn't involved with the team at all. But that's just what he loved to do.
And so it wasn't overstepping. He just came to watch.
He just came to watch.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't think that made, you know, my friend's home life very good.
Mm.
Because what were they probably talking about? Basketball all the time. So did it make him a better basketball player? Hell yeah, I'm sure it did. But I don't think it was probably always fun for him. Whereas I got to go home and be like, how was basketball practice? It was great. Mm. It was terrible. No one knows. I can say whatever I want.
Well, especially if you're saying, you know, you're not going to play. No one's ever going to know, right?
Yeah.
No, I think it's sometimes some of the sadder situations I've seen is parents in any sport pushing their children probably harder than they want to be pushed and just where the kid's not enjoying it anymore. They're playing for the wrong reasons. But I've seen in having been around tennis a little bit, sometimes those solo sports, you've got to be built that little bit different to think that you're the – and golf is probably even, again, a bit different because arguably one of the most mentally challenging and frustrating sports out there. At least with tennis, there are some elements that are out of your control because you've got an opponent to play against you, whereas with golf, it's just you.
Yeah.
And most of the time. And this may be a random question, but is there anything to be, given that it stresses out adults big time, you know, the young people playing golf, they need to be careful how much they emotionally or intellectually invest in it?
I think we assume as junior golfers, a lot of our parents stress.
Mm.
So what really makes my dad upset or my mom upset? Oh, when I miss a four-footer. They really don't like that. So what do I not want to do? I don't want to miss a four-footer.
Yep.
And I think that's probably what I see a lot too is, you know, the parents over to the side being quiet. Kid is 6 years old and he takes him five putts to make it from 3 feet. And the dad's over there rolling his eyes and throwing his hands up in the air. And, and you know, the kid doesn't give a crap because he's six. So he's just, he finally makes it and he gives a fist pump and he's off to the next tee. And the parent's like rolling his eyes and like, oh, I'm like, dude, it doesn't matter. Like, if anything, you're adding to a potential future stress level or anxiety point. And I think that goes for really like anything, again, in life, anything that a parent does, if they're going to say, oh, that's a terrible thing to do, or that really stresses me out, or don't do that to a child, in most cases, that's going to create a mindset for them that, you know, for good or bad, is now a part of their life.
That's a bloody good point, especially it's we're probably always hardest on our own. And I don't have kids, so I can't speak to that. Maybe sometimes when I'm at the dog park and my dog doesn't meet my expectations and stuff, but then it comes back to, well, probably should have taught it a little bit. But anyway.
But if another dog does it, it's fine. It's when your dog does it. That's when it's a problem.
Or I know my dog's being naughty and someone else goes, oh, your dog's so well behaved. And you're like, that's what I needed today. So what would you be doing if you weren't working in kids golf?
So I never thought I would get to this where I'd be managing a company abroad. That kind of fell in place solely because I think I realized how much I enjoyed it. So there's a lot of parts of my day that probably for most people they would think are not fun that I enjoy. Like I enjoy trying to help a parent, a child, pick a set of golf clubs and talk about junior golf and golf tournaments. And, you know, it brings me joy to see them succeed. And, if not, I've had somebody ask me this, recently, I'd probably do what a lot of my friends do in Atlanta, and I'd either sell or build real estate or sell insurance. Being an insurance agent's really good for golfers. Being a mortgage banker of any sort, something like that.
There'd still be some link to golf, you think, in
something
you're doing?
I think if I can get people out on the golf course, like you said, I'm somewhat of a golf Yoda, so maybe if I can get people out on the golf course to do something, I feel like I have a great opportunity to make a good connection with them. And a lot of times in sales, something I try really, really hard to do is think about what the person needs, not what I want them to buy. And that helps me to be the salesman I want to be. You know, I think in sales, a lot of times, if you're not a salesman or you think it's gross that someone's a salesman, it's because you think they are just out for themselves and they just want to make money. But if you can put your head on the pillow every day going, I only tried to help people today and I have a product that I sell. Sure, it was great when I sold some, but sometimes I told people they didn't need it because they didn't. Then you're not really a salesman. You're just helping people.
I remember my first job out of uni was selling gym memberships. And it was around about that time that there was the contracts and things. Like you'd sit down and you'd have the sheet, you write down, fill it out. And it's all guiding the conversation to get to like, are you going to do the weekly option? Are you going to pay up front? And I found that some people were coming in and sharing information with me that they wouldn't share with the average person, particularly about their health, if they want to lose weight or tone up or get in shape for a special life moment or whatever. And then there was some sort of, can I ask you? You're like, so you're doing the ask. You're like, what are we going to do today, the easy or the advanced option?
Right.
And they're like, oh, I need to check. I don't know. I want to check with my partner, with my mum or my dad or whatever. And I remember once the job was to sell memberships. The manager of the club, fitness club, came up to me and they said, we don't tell people it's okay to go home and think about it, or you don't have to make a decision today. And I got reprimanded for it. And I was like, yep, this is not the industry for me, because I could sell, but I didn't have it in me to pressure someone or do that. And I feel like there's that apprehension, you're right, with salespeople that they're trying to get their commission, they're not actually trying to help you, and it's that 10% again who probably give the majority of them a bad name.
I'd work for Average Joe's gym. I wouldn't work for the one across the street from Dodgeball, what that movie
Globo?
Is. Yeah.
Bro.
I wouldn't work for Globo Gym. I'd work for Average Joe's, because I'm with you. I'd want people to want to be there, and it doesn't matter where you are and what you are, just if you want to be there, that's great. But that's a much harder way to make money.
If you want to, mate, I actually did just that. I left the Average Joe's gym at the end of my street and went and joined a bigger
Oh, yeah, yeah.
A conglomerate. And it's like literally almost same branding, like Bright Purple Crunch Fitness or something, I think
yeah.
it is. And
yeah.
they were fine because I just went and said, look, A, because I know, and I said, just, yeah, I'll just sign me up. It's the same price. They've got more stuff. Like, that's fine. But there's twice as many people there. It's a little bit further away. And I don't know why I did it. I think I just wanted, like, a change. But that's exactly how I felt. I've just gone to, I'm at, like, Globo Fitness. I'm waiting for buddy Ben Stiller to pop out around the corner. So you've come there. We play basketball together. And you're pretty handy. And how, for someone who doesn't say, have you just been hooping your whole life? In between, like, how do you sort of keep up a relative level of skill if you're not playing, say, like weekly, or have you been?
So there was a good couple of years where I didn't play because it was hard to play. There wasn't any gym, there wasn't any league for me to play in. But I was always I don't want to run anymore because I did that and it's not fun for me. But I will go play basketball way too competitively. With a whole bunch of people I don't know in the park. And that's just how I always kept it up. So it was my way of fitness. It's like some people go on a run, I'm gonna go down to the park and try to play basketball. And sometimes I got to play, sometimes I didn't. But when I got to play, it was a great workout.
How often, because that makes me anxious, like rolling up to the park and not being able to play.
Yeah.
Like what's the strike rate of being able to get a go?
I'm sure it depends on whatever city you're in and whatever neighborhood, but. I think it's a lot like getting so lucky to join Support Bros.
Mm.
You know, the only reason I got to join and meet you and play with all of you guys was because you guys needed somebody that day.
Yeah.
So I was the fill-in. Yep. And then within, I think, one or two games, everybody was like, yeah, Bill's pretty handy. You can be on the team if you want, which was, you know, amazing for me. But that's exactly how the park worked.
Yeah.
So, like, you go to the park, you don't play a lot. You barely play unless they need somebody. And then... they kind of know, and they're like, "All right, we'll take Bill. He's not bad. We'll take Bill."
And like then you white get to play. Man can't jump.
Yeah, a little bit. They'd make fun of me and call me Manu Ginobili. So I don't know what that says. I think it says I have a big nose. And
mate, well, look, you know, you remind me of a bloke off the video game. Might be NBA Hang Time, maybe. Mm. But if your hair was like white, it's like the old man.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's like the thin guy that's got all the moves and stuff. But my only experience with that was I was in New York. I was living there, but I wasn't. I was just waiting for a visa to come through. So I was in Hell's Kitchen for about 6 weeks and would go down and just walk past the court where the guys are playing. And I never played. Let's get that. Very clear. But I walked in there and realized I had no business being in there on some of those courts. And it wasn't anywhere famous. Not like, was it Rucker Park or is it?
I know what you mean. Like it was just
a court.
Run-of-the-mill court in the city.
And I just looked at these guys and to me, they looked like they should play in the NBA. Like these guys could hoop. And they said, hey man, how's it going? I said, yeah, good. So you want to... And I didn't have my, I said, nah, like that. And I just backed out like Homer Simpson in the bush. I was like, nah, I've got to get out of there. But yeah, and I think... It seems like a pretty healthy culture as far as like pickup sports go.
For sure. I think, if anything, basketball is one of the easiest things to play in the States when it comes to, you know, a lot of YMCAs have a gym, have a court. A lot of churches have courts, and they might just have an open run two nights a week at a church. So, you know, kind of different than the way you guys see churches. Our churches can be quite mega.
Yeah.
So they could have a pool, they could have a basketball court.
And can anyone roll in, or you need to be a member of the parish to?
You wouldn't need to be a member of the parish. You might just need to know somebody that's a member of the parish.
Yeah, right.
So I know Dusty. Oh yeah, okay, you're good.
You're good.
Come on in.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've got a mean skyhook.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Sure, you can come in too.
Yeah, exactly. it's just probably one of those things that really, like, I think any sport just helps people come together.
Mm.
So if you're willing to give it a crack, like you said, you got asked if you wanted to give it a run. They were keen, but they really probably just wanted to see how bad you were.
Well,
but that's part of it, right?
That the worst nightmare happened. I just had moved from Toronto to Vancouver, and this is 15 years ago. So I was still in some sort of what I would consider maybe athletic prime, and a girl that I worked with. Her partner asked me to come down and play flag football. And I've been just getting into the NFL and stuff, being in like North America, you know, Sunday night football, that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yeah, I always, to myself, I was like, I could play that game.
Oh,
like,
for sure.
No problem.
Yeah.
And flag is like not even going to get tackled. I'm like, I'll just dominate. So we went down and I roll up wearing footy shorts with skins underneath. And firstly, they just like looked at us and they're like, what's with the weird shorts? And I'm like, oh, I play footy and they're this, whatever. And they're like, okay, buddy, you're like rugby guy or whatever. And it's not, like, not even going to bother trying to answer that. And then anyway, so we're playing and went okay. Like I think I was on defense first and not got like an interception, but did some good stuff. A few stops or that sort of thing, made it hard work for someone. And then I was like, I reckon I got these guys covered. Like I can, I know
I'm quicker than them.
Yeah. So anyway, QB goes back and just airs one out. And I'm watching. I was like, yeah, got it. And that sinking feeling when you know it's going over your head and the guy's in behind you and lit me up. Like he was 15 meters in front of me, caught it, way he went. It was like blown cover, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And then afterwards, the guy who invited me down, he goes, cheer up, buddy. He goes, that guy got a full ride at UNLV to make you look that bad.
Yeah.
I was like, all right, that makes you feel a little bit better.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's I think that's the it's same as some of the basketball games I've played with you. You play against guys, and they're like, oh yeah, he played like NBL for a little bit, and you're like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. Or like, oh yeah, he played in the AFL for 8 years, and you're like, right, all right, that's why it hurt so much when he hit me.
No, I think it was the game. Yeah, Maxi Gorn, Corey Mano, we're looking at you guys. Like, yeah, Corey's.
Yeah, that elbow hurt. Yeah.
Well, and Corey's like, oh, go easy on me. Like, yeah, a bit sore. I was like, oh, this guy's wearing a hoodie. You know, I had no idea. I knew he'd maybe played a bit of footy, and then just lit me up for three in a row. I'm like,
yeah.
Okay, like that's on me. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yeah, he didn't realize he played Division I basketball in the States. And it makes a lot of sense once you watch him shoot and then hear that news, you're like, yes, that sandwich goes together. That,
once again, information would have been good half an hour ago.
Yeah.
Mate, something we ask everyone who comes on here, and it's one of my favorite parts of the show. What would you say are some of your core values?
I only have one. It's to do my best to treat people the way I want to be treated, which I feel like is super hard. You can call it the golden rule or whatever you want, but just trying my best to leave anyone that I see that day better off makes me happy. And then my next thing that I try to do every day is put my head on the pillow, knowing that I gave it a crack, as you like to say. So every single day, if I didn't give it a crack, I should be angry that I didn't try a little bit harder. But if I can put my head on the pillow saying, hell of a day, whatever it is that I did, that makes me want to get up again the next day and be happy.
Love it. Simple but effective. I like it, man.
Sometimes.
Yeah, beautiful. Bill Basil, thank you very much for being a guest on the Dusty Allen Show. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome,
and
man.
I'm sure we'll see you back here again. But before then, I'll probably see you on the basketball court or the golf course.
Yeah, let's do both.
Beautiful, mate. Thank you.
Thank you.
G'day, team. If you like what you hear on this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. I'd really appreciate it, and it helps the podcast reach new audiences. Please give at The Dusty Allen Show a follow on Instagram for latest show updates and video clips from the show. The Dusty Allen Show is produced by me, Dusty Allen, with the help of the fine gentlemen at Beagle and Hound Studios. The theme music is produced by Stephen Savelli and is recorded at Beagle and Hound Studios in Brunswick, Melbourne.